Today, I'm very pleased to have on the show an extraordinary woman. She is a journalist, performance artist, and a musician, and she happens to be transgender. We're talking about her book, which has just come out, called The New Girl. She is Rhiannon Stiles, who made the decision to live like a woman rather than die like a man. Hi, Rhiannon. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hiya. Thanks for having me.
Can we start at the beginning with your childhood?
Yeah, sure.
Did you know you were different, and if so, when?
I suppose I knew that there wasn't something which quite matched within myself, but at that age I didn't know how to contextualize that. I didn't have the vocabulary. We didn't know in the 1980s that the word transgender really existed where I was from, and so I suppose in that sense no one really in the country knew exactly what transgender was. I knew I was different, but I didn't know what that different was.
Yeah. Just knew whatever it was, it didn't fit.
Something didn't fit. I wouldn't say that I felt like I knew I was a girl at that age, because I certainly felt that there were long periods of my life when I was comfortable being the previous identity which I had, but I just wasn't quite like in tune with the rest of the boys, I suppose, is the easiest way of putting it. And I didn't feel that that was really me. I related to girls when I was younger in a much more kind of emotional way than I did with boys. And my behavior was certainly what you would describe as more feminine than masculine.
Yes, I think you described it as you as a child, as a chubby femme acting boy that befriended your mum and the cheese hedgehog at the buffet table.
I like that line. Yeah, I was referring to parties. I'd be invited to male classmates' parties, and I very much felt like I was being invited because they had to, because I was a boy in the class, as opposed to kind of being my friend. I didn't have close relationships with males when I was growing up, and so yeah, at parties quite often the boys would be in the front room playing Sabutio, which is a table football game, and I hated Sabutio. I didn't relate to it at all, so more often than not I'd be in the other room kind of like eating my way through the buffet table and chatting to the friends' mums about hair or something. I was very happy doing that.
Still the best. The kitchen's still the best place in the party anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so what was it? Tell me a bit about the community, your family growing up and the community. And so there's one thing about feeling different internally, but then also, you know, how people treat you externally.
Well, I grew up in a very small community, in a little village in Staffordshire, which was probably about 300 people. It was very isolated. As a result of that isolation, it was very racist, homophobic and transphobic, although we didn't really understand the terms homophobic and transphobic again in the 80s also. I suppose as I was an outsider in that village, I felt very much like the only person who potentially could be gay or transgender. There wasn't any other kind of people around the village that certainly displayed those traits, and so I didn't really relate to anybody in that community. And I suppose as a teenager I was walking around with like shoulder length blue hair. And back in the 1990s, people didn't really have shoulder-length blue hair. They do now, but not then. So I just really stuck out like a sore thumb in that village, really. I didn't really fit into the humdrum of the village and the things that the village people did or talked about. I was always desperate for more culture, more life, you know, more expression, more fun.
And you talk a bit about some of your friendships with other girls, and despite bullying, whatever, you sort of kind of had to stick it out.
Yes.
For lack of anything else.
Yeah.
It would sound like.
Well, I had to. There was really no means of escaping that village until I was 18. And I knew that as soon as I turned 18, I would go. And I would go to a big city and I would start, you know, finding the culture and the people which I so desperately craved. But I suppose my relationships with girls at that time were really strong. And it was the girls in the village as a child that really nurtured me and helped me and allowed me, I suppose, to express my femininity when I felt that the rest of the village kind of wasn't. Yeah. And I owe a lot to those girls because, you know, they really did embrace me for everything that I was and allowed me to be me. And I think we just had a very kind of mutual understanding. I wouldn't say that they thought like, oh, that person is a girl. Or I mean, I didn't even think that I was a girl, but I definitely knew that I related to them, and they allowed me that. Mm. And that's brilliant. Mm.
And talk to me a bit about, I mean, because especially, I don't know, as you can probably hear, I'm from the States, and there is this really disgusting thing in North Carolina about disallowing differently gendered people to go into the bathroom of their sort of assignation.
Yes.
If you will. And there is, you know, with crazy claims, because there seems to be, you did come out as gay.
Yeah.
And you were sort of a gay goth guy,
mm-hmm.
at a certain point.
Yes.
In your teens. People have difficulty, despite them being totally different words with different meanings, gender and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts, feelings, experiences, you know, along those lines.
Well, I suppose because we didn't know transgender really existed for a long time, we knew it existed, but it wasn't really acceptable for a very long time. Being transgender was always seen as something which was scandalous and a joke. So I suppose in the 1990s, homosexuality became much more in the mainstream, and gay men were being celebrated more than ever before. And it's obviously post-AIDS, which I think had a lot to do with that. And I suppose for me, it was like, I always knew that I was attracted primarily to masculinity. And so I aligned my sort of identity. I allowed my identity to be governed by my sexuality. So therefore I thought, okay, well, if I'm in a male body and I like men, predominantly masculinity, that's not to say that masculinity has to come with a penis. I'm very open about that. But, because I'm attracted to masculinity and I'm in the body of a man, maybe that means I'm a homosexual man. And I suppose I ran with that because I didn't know anything differently existed. And it wasn't until much later in my life that I realized, hang on a minute, my sexuality doesn't actually have to govern anything. That's just one small part of me. And I think that's an issue these days with people, is that they need to kind of break away the idea of gender identity and sexual identity. And once you learn about that, actually things like these bathroom things don't matter at all, because it's not about trying to pull someone going in a different bathroom. It's just simply about being comfortable.
Yeah. So you do finally escape.
Yes.
You know, bright lights, big city,
yeah.
Art school, London. What was that? Was there an immediate affinity? Was there...
Incredible. I just latched onto this thriving metropolis as soon as I could. And I moved down to London to go to Middlesex University to do a four-year degree in jewellery design. And I always knew that being creative and being artistic was an outlet for me and something which I should always do. I always knew that I was happiest when I was burrowing away in the art department at high school. So it made sense to really think that my life would be creative and that I would be working in many different creative fields. And London just became this gorgeous place for me to feel happy about doing that. And in many different ways, moving to London was also about finding my tribe. And I needed to find people that weren't necessarily just heteronormative, people that I related to that expressed an interest in the same music, films, art as me. And I found it, I think, because London has those pockets of people, and that's what draws all people here, is its rich heritage of culture and expression. And also, I was desperate to escape the confines of a small village, and I really wanted to express myself without fear of being abused for doing so. I wanted sort of the shelter of anonymity in London and to be allowed to be me without anyone really batting an eyelid. And there was safety in that, and massive period of growth. I really grew from being this young, naive person into suddenly flourishing into this new world.
Hmm.
It was amazing.
And also, it sounds like you hit East London, you moved to East London at the exactly best time. You know, it was thriving nightclubs, mm-hmm. you know, nightlife with all that entails.
Well, it was also deliciously, yeah, it was also deliciously cheap.
Yes.
So back in 2000, when I moved to the area of Hackney, I was paying next to nothing for accommodation, which in many ways was perfect to be a student at that time. So,
and also you discovered yourself as, you know, one of your artistic expressions as a performer.
Yes.
In nightclubs.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I always knew that my presentation was a means to communicate something to the world. When I finished university, during university, I became quite a fixture on a London clubbing scene. And around the early noughties, there was this scene called Electro Clash. And there was lots of clubs that were popping up, which were very heavily focused on aesthetics and how you dressed and what you wore. And people wore really crazy expressive outfits. A lot of people related it back to the early 80s and the Blitz Kids scene. So there was definitely a lot of flamboyance, and there was definitely a lot of men wearing makeup. And I could relate to that. That was something which, for me, had been integral in my life. I'd grew up always wearing makeup. So to now be able to wear makeup in this world was just perfect. And it wasn't long before I was going out so much and wearing expressive clothes that people just started offering me jobs in clubs. So I would start working on the door, or I'd do the cloakroom. And I slowly progressed to like doing performances, because I was making these outfits which heavily lent themselves to performance because they were so expressive and crazy. So I didn't really need to do much in them, but I just needed to be on stage. And I loved it because I wanted that limelight, and I wanted to be in the spotlight. And it was a way of me expressing my identity and starting to think about my gender more deeply.
And also you were meeting a lot more drag queens, and that was, you know, that kind of fluidity, that kind of identity expression,
mm-hmm.
as you say, as opposed to sexual expression,
yeah,
which is distinct, was probably becoming more distinct in your mind. You're like, oh, right.
Yeah, exactly. I was meeting drag queens and transvestites and transgendered women who were all using nightclubs as a platform to express themselves. And I really related to that. And it was when I started to feel like, actually, there isn't anything wrong with this. Like, I grew up in that village mentality of anyone expressing themselves outside of the heteronormative world being bad. And when I got to London, that's what I realized, is I was holding on to these kind of things that were ingrained in me that weren't true. And seeing these people in that environment just made me go, actually, like, I can be who I want to be. And starting to think about my gender identity because I saw these people actively doing the same really encouraged me.
Yeah. You needed a bigger village.
Exactly.
So I think at one point you were going to do a show as Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And then started the long, arduous process of becoming Rhiannon.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the, as you called it, the tipping point, but what pushed you to start that process?
It was around the end of 2011. I started to feel more and more unhappy about myself. I wasn't able to really hold my life together. It felt very unmanageable. There were certain things I had, which was fantastic. I was in a really stable relationship, and I had a flat, and all these kind of material things that seemed to sort of booster, and people would say, oh, you're doing really well. But underneath all that, I felt hollow. I felt really like I wasn't living up to my true self and who I truly felt I was. I felt like I was trying to be this very masculine being, and I just knew that wasn't right. I mean, I'd also sort of heavily got involved into patterns of behavior which weren't particularly beneficial to my life. So I was using a lot of substances as a way of dealing with this negativity which I felt about myself. Although at the time I wasn't aware that that's why I was doing it. But in hindsight, I can now see that very clearly. At the start of 2012, I just got to a point where I was just so low that I was like, I need to make this change. It was, the idea of transitioning was always there. During my 20s, I knew that that's what I should do. And the more and more people I met along the way, it bolstered that belief. When Channel 4 screened a documentary in 2011 called My Transsexual Summer, which followed the lives of seven trans people at varying stages of their transition, I knew that that was what I had to do. And it was amazing that Channel 4 did that, because it showcased transgender people as normal, happy, healthy, living people in society. And that's when I really go, okay, I need to look at this. At the start of 2012, I just said to myself, what is making you so unhappy? And the answer that came back was, you're not living as you should. So I started making the small steps in the arduous long process of this transition. Yeah.
Yeah. And you document that both here, but you also documented that in a blog, in mm-hmm. sort of step by step. Why did you choose to do that? And did it help you, did it make it harder?
It's certainly a way of you being able to understand in a different way than just thinking about it. When you're writing down experiences of your life and the way you feel and how you deal with situations, you're able to look at it and read about it differently. So I found that by documenting my transition and blogging about my transition really allows me to access insight into myself, which I wouldn't normally have. And I think writing the book, especially having something which is such a big encyclopedia of my thoughts and feelings, is a way of me able to kind of unpick all this behavior and look at my life in such a respect to try and make sense of it. It's really helpful.
What were some of the because you did this on the NHS, what were some of the stumbling blocks that you ran into?
It's difficult transitioning on the NHS in the respect that it just takes time. Mm-hmm. The NHS have been really supportive and brilliant for my transition. I've hardly felt... I couldn't have done it another way, basically. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the means to do a private transition, seeking private gender specialists. So the biggest obstacles is time. You have to wait and go through several assessments by clinicians. You have to wait for appointment times and are very in high demand because of the people that are accessing the clinic. So it's frustrating knowing that your next appointment with the clinic isn't going to be for another 8 months. But at the same time, I really used that time to start to generate self-love and self-care for myself, because I knew that instead of banging my head against the wall and worrying about like when this time would come, it would come. So I needed to focus on the here and now.
Yeah. What was that time like? Was that a time of passing? I mean, so you had decided to live as a woman, but so, you know, you're not getting the steps, you know, that you, you know, in... they're coming. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, so what do you do in the meantime? So do you try and pass as a woman and all that entails?
Yeah, I tried to do all that I could. And I'm lucky in the respect that I wasn't born with very typical masculine traits. I didn't have lots of body hair. I have like sort of fair, soft skin. I have soft hair. I never really had lots of facial hair. I don't have male pattern balding. I'm not really tall. I don't have really big feet. All these kind of typically associated masculine traits. So I suppose when I first started to dress in a female presentation full time, it didn't take much for me to pass as a word of looking like a woman. I didn't sound like a woman though, and that also caused me distress. And also, you know, some people got it. Some people could see that I was transgender and they acknowledged me as such. Some people saw me still as an effeminate man, and some people saw me as a woman and didn't know. So I think it depends on you, the viewer's eye, and how you're trained with identity and what you know. But I did all I could, and that meant that, you know, changing my wardrobe, starting to have laser hair removal on my face to remove my my stubble and my facial hair, and waiting for the clinic to be able to prescribe me hormones. And to do that, you have to live as a woman for a year before they give that. So it's actually quite a difficult time period, because I changed my name in April 2012 to Rhiannon, and from that point on I started presenting as female every day. But obviously I couldn't replace my wardrobe in one go. So I didn't have the financial means to do so. So I was sort of putting female clothes that I'd buy in Primark quite cheaply with my masculine clothes that weren't typically that masculine. So kind of typically like skinny jeans or something and Converse trainers. I suppose the result wasn't an overtly feminine appearance, but it wasn't masculine either. It was some fluid thing in between. I wasn't happy with that, but at the same time, that's all I could do and I accepted it. But yeah, those first few years were challenging in that respect because you're trying to do everything you can and move forward with an identity, but you feel like you're being held back. There were times when I was like followed around Tesco by people and they'd be like, that's a man, that's a man, that's a man. And that's just really frustrating. And I think for some people, that's really intimidating and scares people to leave the house. But I'm actually quite thick skinned and I can kind of, I dealt with that. In a way, I think that didn't harm me. But yeah, you need bravery to go on the tube, for example, when people are staring at you and you're in close proximity with people under lights that are very unflattering when you've just had laser hair removal and your face is bright red.
Yeah.
So do you know what I mean? Like there are those sort of things to consider, which make it tough.
Well, and it's an interesting paradox is because you're striving to integrate a larger internal process.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the nitty gritty, the sort of bits and pieces, you know, are harder. But I think that's for anyone. I mean, I have a trans woman I know was telling a mutual friend she was really upset, you know, like her boobs were saggy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my friend said to her, well, you know, you are, you know, 40, whatever. And she's like, but they're only 16.
Welcome to womanhood.
Exactly. But to me, that spoke of, you know, a more, yes, the bigger integration has happened, but an internal, not nuts and bolts, but integration hasn't occurred. But I think that happens with anybody. I don't like I hate my, you know, my boobs or I mm-hmm. hate my butt or mm-hmm, I hate, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. it's the same
Yeah, I
thing.
Think that exactly a lot of the things we're experiencing are universal things for women of all identifications. And that's what you realize when you transition is when it really clicked for me is when this society started viewing me as a woman and I was treated as a way that women are treated. And that's when you see the big differences.
Yeah,
and
for better or for worse.
Yeah, and the sexism which is involved in this society. And if you speak to trans men, they say the same thing.
Yeah.
That when they're perceived as men, it's a whole different world. So in that respect, yeah, I'm very kind of conscious of that. And I'm very careful nowadays as my role in society has changed, yeah. Mm.
And tell me about some of the other people, you know, that you met, like in the clinic in Hammersmith. There were, you know, people at all different stages, but certainly a tribe of people who were, you know, going through similar experiences.
Yeah, whenever I went to the gender identity clinic, I was pleasantly surprised because the waiting room was always full. And people generally seemed happy to be there. And you just realise that people are getting on with their lives and that the NHS is really supporting this this condition. And I saw older women who were wearing sort of grey wigs. And I saw younger girls who were with their parents who seemed much more kind of androgynous and gender fluid. And I saw trans men who were just really like the biggest butchest men I'd ever seen in my life. So it was a really good spectrum of gender, and it was really comforting to know that everyone was there, really, and that everyone, every sort of identity was being being included.
Mm. Mm. And through this, how difficult was it to, you know, keep your life normal? I know what you're saying is that the blog was sort of helping you
mm-hmm.
To at least see yourself somewhat from the outside so that it wasn't entirely an internal experience. But, you know, you were saying before in a relationship, some substance issues, having a flat, like what was, you know, you have a family. I understand you were still very close with your sister. So what was the fallout, as it were?
The fallout of transitioning. Well, my relationship came to an end because I needed some time and some space to think about what I was going to do. And I thought that the best thing to do would be to do that alone, in terms of not in a relationship. And you know, my partner was incredibly supportive. I mean, he knew that it was the end of the relationship in terms of a sexual meeting of two people, because we began the relationship as two male-identifying people, and my partner at that time wasn't interested in being with someone who was female because he identified as a gay man. So that came to an end, but I was so grateful because I had his support for like another 6 months. We carried on living together, and he became a very kind of valuable asset and supportive person in my life for that time before he moved out. And I was really grateful to have his friendship after everything we'd been through in a relationship. And then my friends kept me normal. They kept me kind of on top of my life and kept me sane, I suppose. They allowed me to make mistakes. They supported me. They embraced my change of name and my identity, and they went with it. I also, very early on in my transition, in March 2012, I became sober, and I started going to 12-step recovery programs to address the many forms of things I abused, people, places, and things. And so that enabled me to kind of have a bit more clarity in my mind and cleared out the space to be able to move forward in a transition in the best positive, healthy mindset I could, because to transition is not something to do on a whim. It's something which is to change not just your life, but everyone else's life you know. And that's huge. So you can't muck around with this kind of thing. You have to be deadly serious and on top of it to do it, you know. And that's what I did. And by putting a transition as the focus of my life and putting all my energy into that, everything else around the side fell into place, because I had this purpose now, and I was on this pursuit of being true to myself and being able to live up to the person that I wanted to be and that I'd always known I was going to be. So I didn't want anything to jeopardize that situation. So I made damn right sure that everything was going to happen as I wanted it to.
Yeah, I was going to say, because then, and I don't know if it is just a stereotype or if it is used, or if it is true, or if it is something used as one of our weapons to be normative. But there is a stereotype that trans people are more likely, you know, the substance abuse, depression, suicide, is rife. And I think, I mean, to me, it makes sense that it would be true, just because it's something at the heart of you. You know, as somebody else put it, you know, even if you're, if you're being sort of abused because of your race, well, you go home and your family's all the same.
Yeah.
But this is it's a very lonely, lonely reckoning with yourself and then reckoning with the world.
Yeah. There's a thing about growing up, being transgender, feeling different, being gay, being black, being whatever it may be that is different to white heteronormative society. And we internalize a lot of that pain. I think growing up as a queer kid and feeling very much like an outsider, and society treats me like an outsider, I'm not surprised that I myself and many other trans people have these issues of substance abuse and suicide. It's a really
escape.
And I think what I've learned in the last 5 years of transitioning is that I really needed to sort out my mental health. That was where it all lay. And I needed to embrace myself, love myself, and cherish the beautiful person that I am. Because throughout my life, many people had told me that I wasn't good enough, and that I couldn't do this, and I couldn't do that, and I couldn't be a woman. And that's the problem, is that there's all these kind of constraints of like, well, we're male or female, and anything else just isn't acceptable. And to be honest, I think generally, a lot of people will feel comfortable within the brackets of male and female, but there's many more that don't. And the amount, if we just allow people to be, as opposed to trying to categorize people, then maybe we wouldn't have such high rates of depression, suicide, and bad mental health.
Yes, I've never understood why anyone else's gender identity or sexual identity had anything to do with me, unless I wanted to be with them or be them or something. You know what I mean?
It's, exactly.
It really doesn't. Your journey, other than sharing as another human, really has no impact on me.
Yeah, and absolutely.
It really shouldn't be my business.
No, exactly.
But
I carried a lot of pain for a long time because of that, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time to shake off that pain. And it's a daily process for me. I'm still working it out. And I'm much more comfortable with who I am today. But that old feedback and those thought processes and that experience of the younger me still haunts me and still dictates a lot of my decision making today. And unfortunately, that's something I still work on, but at least I'm doing that. And I just hope that my book is able to be there for other people to reference, mm-hmm. that other people who are transitioning, people who are much younger or older, who are starting this journey, and for those people that aren't transitioning who want to know more about a transgender narrative and experience, that this book will do that for people. It'll be the inlet that they need.
Yeah. Mm. And I think a lot of people have been surprised. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner very publicly has transitioned. But so to, and I think something that surprised people in her story is that she didn't have final surgery, and a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is obviously personal and different for everyone. Tell me about your decision to do that.
Well, my decision was, when I first started my transition, I thought I would start at A and I'd be at B. And I thought my transition would be one very linear line, and that I was going to have this done, I'd take this, I'd do that, and then therefore fast forward 3 years and poof, I'd be this woman. But actually I realized that things don't always go to plan, and that things change, and that your thoughts change and your feelings change and your ideas about yourself change. The more I went through my transition, the more I started living and breathing and experiencing the world as Rhiannon, the more I got comfortable on the medication I was taking. So I take estrogen, and I take anti-testosterone medication to reduce my testosterone and higher my estrogen, so that my chemical levels inside my body are that of a genetic born female. And the more I felt comfortable and relaxed in the body that I had, the more I felt at ease. And I suppose my decision about my overall kind of idea about who I want to be was, I found out, was really based on other people's perceptions of what a woman is. And I thought about it, and the more I thought about it, I thought, like, well, hang on, I was in this camp called males over here, and I wasn't comfortable being a male because I wasn't, like, you know, I didn't believe that you had to be strong and you had to be a provider and all this kind of, all these words that associate with masculinity that the commercial world wants to put on it. I was like, why am I then going to be this? Well, why do I then think I'm going to be this in this woman's camp, and I have to be this, this, and this? And actually, like, part of me is actually not comfortable with that. I don't want to reinforce this masculine idea of femininity. And I don't feel that particularly my genitalia has any role in my gender identity. And so therefore, I feel that I'm doing something primarily because of other people's assumptions of what a woman should be. And really, my gender expression is for me to decide. And however I decide to live my life is personal to me. And I don't need to necessarily follow this script of what a woman should be to do so. And when I realized that and let go of that fear, I felt like I was born again. It was brilliant.
What was it like? I always see it as an opportunity, but an uncomfortable opportunity to then go through puberty in your 30s when you think you're older and wiser, but actually the hormones rule us.
Yep, I first noticed
hormones are in charge.
Yeah, they are. And I first noticed things had changed. I was watching a reality TV show on BBC One called The Voice. And I was having, like, a TV dinner. It was Saturday night. I was really cozy. And I was watching this TV show, and the woman was singing with Tom Jones. And I just started crying. I don't know why. I was just like a blithering wreck. And I couldn't stop myself from crying. And I was like, why am I crying? This is not even sad. But I suppose that it was emotional. And for the first time, I really was aware that my emotions were much more to the surface than ever before. And yeah, there are days when I just had these incredible strops, and I don't know where they come from. It's not like anything's gone wrong, but I'll just be in this kind of state of just feeling a bit more kind of vulnerable that day or whatever it is. So, yeah, going that is going through puberty again. It was very different than when I went through puberty as a teenager. And also the things like, you know, my breasts have developed and my body's changed. The softness of my skin has changed. My hair texture has changed. And I feel like I'm through it now. I feel like 3 years into the medical side of my transition, I'm comfortable and I have less of those kind of crazy moments. But I wouldn't want to go back there.
Again.
No.
Again.
Definitely not.
Okay. And so what's, have you been dating? Are you?
Yes. That's a great question. I'm in a relationship. I've been in a relationship for the last 2 years. Well, coming up to 2 years. He's a brilliant guy. He's somebody that has enabled me to grow so much. He really embraces who I am. He really accepts me for who I am. He shows support when it's totally necessary. And he's also able to, you know, be there to give me advice on things that I'm still struggling with. And I've loved that. I've loved being in that relationship because I'm much stronger as a result of that. Before him, I was dating and it was a bit of a nightmare because, you know, as again, things like dating apps are really set up for men binary. Who like women. Yeah, binary things. Men who like women or men who like men or women who like women. And when you're transgender and you put yourself beyond those categories, it's very difficult to... Well, it's not difficult, but there's a lot of explaining you have to do. So for an example is I would put pictures of myself on my dating profile and I would put, I'm a transgender woman, and people would message me and be like, oh, you look good. You know, it's very superficial, those things. They'd be like, you're hot, you look good. I'd be like, yeah, thank you. You're not bad yourself. And then like, and we'd have a conversation. I'd be like, have you read my profile blurb? And in my profile blurb, I would say I'm a transgender woman, explain a little bit about what that was, but people wouldn't read that. And they'd just go on this, they'd just look at pictures. So I felt like I was always having to explain myself over and over again. And it got very tedious. And sometimes, unfortunately, men felt they were able to be really nasty. And they, from behind the safety of their phone screens, they said really horrible things. I didn't invite that abuse, but I was definitely subjected to it. So,
is that one of the moments where you felt, oh, I'm a woman?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's going on here? Why do you feel the need to be able to say all this to me when I'm just being honest with you and telling me who I am? So I actually decided as a game to take off that I was transgender off my profile and not mention it. And when I did so, the replies and the messages that men sent me were so vastly different. It was a really interesting thing to do. I never met any of those men because I knew that being honest and true about who I was the only way I was going to have a relationship. So I didn't want to go and meet someone, pretend that I wasn't transgender, because there would be no point. I would just be being dishonest to myself. So I met my partner because I was really honest about who I was and he was really honest about who he was. And as soon as I saw him, I just had this inkling of going like, this guy really matches the person what I want. And ironically, his name is Ryan, which was my previous name. So it's just brilliantly designed.
So we've come full circle.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that is you know, the best thing about a relationship, that someone brings out the best in you and you see the best of yourself in them.
Yes, absolutely. And when I'm being the worst, he says, you're being the worst too. Exactly. You know?
You need someone to call you on the shit.
Stop being a stroppy little girl and get on with it. I don't care if it's your hormones or not.
Yeah, exactly. It's still you.
Yeah.
Hormones and all.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Explain yourself better. Anyway, well, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, Rhiannon. And if you're interested in the book, which I suggest you be, The New Girl by Rhiannon Stiles is out now and published by Headline.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.